All right. Here we go, guys. Are you ready? What do we do? Love God and love others. What do we say? I love God and I love you. Amen. I am so excited to be here this morning. I got a really cool announcement to make. We were voting on a new kind of logo. If you had seen that in your email, I saw it on Facebook or Instagram. And the results are in. Ta-da! So here's the logo that we was voted in right there, the dark blue one. I want to just, looking good. I want to just go over why this logo is important and some of the things I want you to see. So that's the mini version of that. I'll go back to that big version. I want to look at that real fast. On this one, the first thing that's going to pop out is the nice blue. And the reason we're looking at blue is because it really reminds us of water. And Jesus says that he's the living water. And our church desires to be a church where people can come and be refreshed, where they could be nourished by the necessary life-giving qualities of water that come. And what water we mean? Jesus, right? And we want a church to be a church where the living water flows through us to other people. And so I love that, the blue part of that. You'll see the sun up there. The sun reminds us that there are God's mercies are new every single day. And so when you see that sun, just be reminded today is a brand new day. And the sun also looks a little bit like a crown, reminding us that Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. On there, you see four mountains. I love these. In our church, we have four vision distinctives. I don't know if you have been following it as we've been trying to share that, but in our church, there's four things that we're trying to become in terms of our identity, our family, our community, and our diversity. If you want to know a little bit more about those, check out the website, jerichoroad.church, in the About section. It'll tell you a little bit more about those four distinctives. And overall, I think the vibe of this logo is just kind of a cool OC vibe, calm, you know. That's where we are. It's not overly, like, intense or in your face. We had looked at some that looked like UFC logos or, like, race car logos and that kind of stuff. But this one just fits kind of our OC vibe, and I really like it. And right down the middle, there is a road. You know, we are Jericho Road Church, and I love that part. We are on this road together, and we're helping others along. As we love God and we love other people. So excited about that. Check out Facebook. I'll show you the breakdowns of the voting, the percentages, a little bit later today. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff. But the other ones, we'll see different color schemes for retreats and that kind of stuff. So if you like the other ones, they're going to show up for some special events. So we're really excited. And I want to thank a brother of ours who is at this church who does a graphic design and logo stuff, Paul Scott, for giving us a bunch of ideas. And then also thank you to those that helped refine it. There was a group of folks who were just giving in their input and that kind of stuff, and so we just thank you for that. Fantastic. All right, we got a lot to cover today in Mark chapter 9. We're looking at simply Jesus, and there's a ton of stuff going on. The title of this sermon is called The Least, and so let's just dive right into it in Mark chapter 9. It starts in verse 2 here. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him, and he led them up to a high mountain where they were all alone. Then he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anything in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. And Peter, he said to Jesus, like, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He didn't know what to say. They were so frightened. Have you ever been there? You don't know, like, you're so scared you don't know what to say. You just said some random thing like, we'll build shelters for you. Anyway, then the cloud appeared and a cloud covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. This is my son whom I love. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. And so here in this passage, for a moment, Jesus offers them a glimpse of his glory. Now, we know that he's left heaven, he took on bodily form, and this just gives them a taste of it. And it's so interesting to me because all that they could describe, like maybe they were going to describe Jesus at first, and he was just like, well, his clothes, they're really bright, the clothes, they're bright. And so that's the kind of thing they highlighted. Why don't you tell me something about like what Jesus looked like? What was his face like? Did he get bigger when he trans? Like, what happened? Like, oh, come on. And you're talking about like his clothes looked bleached, dazzling white. That's the thing that struck you? Maybe the other was too overwhelming to say. I don't know. But I just wish they had elaborated a little bit. And so here he is like all like, in his like dazzling white clothes and stuff. That doesn't mean he was white. We don't want it just a European Jesus, right? He's still Jewish. He didn't turn white. His clothes just gleamed white. Hashtag no racism or something like that, right? And so then also with the Moses and Elijah appear. How cool is that? Moses and Elijah, they've been dead for a long time. In fact, Moses has been dead for more than 1,400 years. So why did they show up here? Now, the Bible doesn't explain, but one guess would be Moses represents the law and Elijah represents the prophets. And so here you have the law and the prophets coming and confirming Jesus as God the Father says, this is my son who I'm well pleased. Like that kind of thing, you know, listen to him. And so that's one sort of idea. But I think it's really telling to look at Moses and Elijah showing up here because it demonstrates that there is life beyond this life. See, Moses and Elijah, they've been dead for a long, long time. And yet here they are, Moses and Elijah. So though their body is dead, they're not actually dead. And they were recognizable as themselves. They didn't have a name tag. Hey, I'm Moses, you know, I'm Elijah. And somehow they were recognizable. This kind of gives us a glimpse of what maybe heaven would look like because these people are dead, right? Maybe in heaven, like, we just recognize people. We know who they are, even though we've never been introduced to them. They didn't have a picture of Moses and Elijah. There weren't statues of them. They didn't know what they looked like, and yet all of a sudden they were easily identifiable. And the other really cool thing to me that I noticed from Moses and Elijah being here is that they were actually Moses and Elijah. In our KidVenture Kid Corner here, we heard about Moses, right? And so when he shows up, he's actually the same Moses. When you die and when we die and we go to heaven and we're separated from this body, ultimately we get another body back. But even when you're separated, you stay you. You were created for eternity, one way or the other. You never stop being yourself. Moses is in heaven being Moses. With all the stuff that had happened on his life, he's still those things Moses. Now he's something better, and life is better because he's in heaven, but he's still recognizable as himself, and so will each of us as we get into heaven eventually. And so that's pretty cool to me. And then all just as fast as they show up, just as all this craziness, boom, they're gone. They just disappear. And then they start down the mountainside. As they're coming down the mountainside, Jesus gave them orders. Don't tell anybody what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves. But they were discussing on the way down, what does risen from the dead mean? And they asked him, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And Jesus replies, to be sure, Elijah does come first, and he restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they've done to him everything they wish, just as it was written about him. So this is a really kind of a confusing little moment. So they're coming down, trying to deal with what he was talking about rising from the dead. They didn't quite figure out yet. Now, in hindsight, we know what that means, right? He actually gets crucified and then raises from the dead. But it didn't make sense to a guy who's living right here, and they thought he was going to become the king and that sort of stuff. And so they're a little bit confused. And then they ask this other question about, like, this kind of thing, when the Messiah is going to come. Isn't the Elijah supposed to come before that? Now, that's prophesied in Malachi chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. And it's really clear there when it says, before the coming of the Messiah, Elijah will appear. And so the disciples were wondering, like, if Jesus is the Messiah, then where's Elijah? Now, Jesus affirms the truth of their question. He says, yeah, that's right. The Elijah is, that's true about Elijah. But then he doesn't answer their question. He asks them, like, a totally different question. And so I love that Jesus, he's doing his own thing. He doesn't care what they're asking sometimes. And so he just moves on. And so here are a couple of guesses what maybe Jesus had in mind when he said, like, to be sure Elijah does come first. So the first one is that the prophecy in Malachi is actually dealing with Jesus' second coming, not his first coming. And so that Elijah would be someone, if you read Revelation chapter 11, where there's two witnesses, some people have proposed that perhaps that's the Elijah coming before the second coming of Christ, not the first coming of Christ. And so that prophecy deals with that from Malachi. One option. The other option is that John the Baptist was an Elijah type. And so when John the Baptist came, he was doing the things of Elijah. He was acting in the name of Elijah. And ultimately, John the Baptist does get killed and so is the precursor to Jesus coming, that forerunner. So one of those two probably are the best options. Jesus doesn't explain it, so those are just our ideas, a theologian's ideas, trying to figure out what Jesus might have meant. Either way, Jesus takes this opportunity to challenge the disciples on their understanding of the Messiah. So he hears they're kind of having Messiah talk, right? And he says, how about this question? What about the idea that the Messiah is supposed to suffer? What about this idea that the Messiah has to be, the Son of Man must get rejected? What about that idea? You see, the disciples were really clear in their understanding of the prophecy that the Messiah would come and take over and bring glory and conquer and win. They were all about those verses as they read their Old Testament. But they hadn't focused quite so much on the ones that indicated the Messiah might be a suffering Messiah. Something like in Isaiah talks about it a whole bunch of different times. Like that part they kind of just glossed over, and they grabbed onto the idea that they wanted this conquering Messiah where the Jews come and rule again. And so Jesus challenges that a little bit and saying, why does the Son of Man have to suffer? Something for them to think about as he's talking ultimately about, he's going to tell them that he's come to suffer, die, and pay for sins. When they came to the other disciples, so they're coming down the mountain, they get to where the other disciples are. They saw a large crowd around them, and the teachers of the law were arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder, and they ran to greet him. And he says, hey, what are you guys arguing about? And a man in the crowd answered, teacher, I brought you my son who's possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, he gnashes his teeth, and he becomes rigid. And I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they couldn't. You unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So they brought him, and when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground, and he rolled around, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered, and it has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, said Jesus, everything's possible for the one who believes. And then immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And when Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many were saying like he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand, and he lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. And after Jesus had gone indoors, the disciples, they came and asked him privately, and they were like, why couldn't we do it? Why couldn't we drive that demon out? And he replied, that guy, it only can come out by prayer. So from the context, we assume that the scribes were criticizing the disciples. The scribes, the argument was breaking out, and they're like, oh, I thought you were able to heal people. Why aren't you healing this boy? And so we assume that they're criticizing for their inability to cast out this demon. Now, if their orthodoxy is so right, we wonder why didn't those Jewish scholars cast out the demon, but instead they just left it there. When Jesus comes near, the demon that's inside the boy knows his time is up. He falls down, he comes running, and ultimately Jesus is going to cast that demon out. But I want to focus in just for a moment on the interaction of the Father and Jesus, just for a second, because I think this is really powerful, at least in my life it is. So the guy comes up to him and he says, but if you can do anything, Jesus, could you help me? The man seems unsure if Jesus could actually do anything. And then Jesus flips the if and challenges him to step out in faith. You see that? Saying to the man, no, if you believe, then all things are possible. The guy says like, oh, Jesus, if you can help. And Jesus says, no, it's not about mine. The problem isn't my side, the problem is your side. And he challenges him with this if and you. If you believe, then all things are possible. When we trust God as true and his promises are true, all things are possible. In this case, the man's unbelief, it wasn't like rebellion against God. He didn't like say, I don't believe in you, God, I hate you. It wasn't rejection of God's promises. He didn't deny God's promises. He desired them. And we know this because he brought his kid to Jesus in hope. Like, he wasn't sure it was going to happen, but he was hopeful. Perhaps it just seemed too good to be true. And he didn't know if it was going to happen. So this boy's father answered Jesus' call to faith by responding, I do believe, but help me in my unbelief. And he did have the belief. He believed Jesus had the power, otherwise he wouldn't have come, right? But he also recognized that he had his own personal doubts. So he pleads with Jesus, "Lord, I believe, help me overcome my unbelief." Like this raw, honest plea, it really does speak to me. And I pray this same kind of prayer probably once or twice a month as I'm approaching God about something. Like, I know God can do it. I absolutely believe in God's power. I absolutely believe God does miraculous things, impossible things on this planet right now. But yet, I still have some doubt. And so I pray just like this guy a lot. I say, "God, I do believe in you. I think you can do powerful things in this church, in these people, in this world. But help me in my own doubt. Help me in my unbelief. God, I believe, but I want to believe more." And so I love this part, that this sort of honesty that this guy has. So cool. And then Jesus casts out the demon, and then he instructs the disciples. He tells them, like, this thing can only come out by prayer. But we didn't see Jesus pray. Now, we're going to find out the attitude of the disciples seemed to be that they start to be trusting in themselves. Remember, he gave them power to cast out demons when he sent them out earlier. And now it looks to, like, scholars, as we're looking in the New Testament, that they start to think, like, oh, look how powerful I am. Look how much I can do. And we see this a little bit later because they start to argue about who's the greatest. And it comes up more than one time, them arguing about which disciple's more powerful, which disciple's more better than the other disciple, and that sort of stuff. And so Jesus says, like, look, authority was only effective if it's exercised in dependence on God, not on your own ability. He says, y'all didn't even pray about this one. You were just like, cast it out, look at me. And he's like, what's wrong with you? This is only from a prayerful heart, someone who is connected to God, relying on God's power instead of their own ability or status. Continue on here. They left that place. They passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know that they were there because he was teaching his disciples. And he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." He's been talking more and more about this kind of stuff. But they didn't understand what he meant, and they were afraid to ask him about it. So we feel bad for the disciples because they're like, is that a parable? Is that an analogy? Like, what are you talking? Is that the future? We're not sure what's happening. And so the disciples couldn't quite process what Jesus was saying plainly about him. They couldn't process that he was saying this was his destiny in life when he gets to Jerusalem, that he's going to die and rise again. It didn't fit their internal narrative about what should happen religiously. They thought when the Messiah comes, these are the things that should happen. And when Jesus started to say things that didn't fit that narrative, they got confused and overwhelmed and doubtful. And that is so true of us today. When something goes against how we expect Christianity to go, we get all confused and doubtful. Look, I think that many of us have an unrealistic, unspoken expectation that being a Christian means that no one will get sick in my life and no one will die. That being a Christian means that my business will go well, that we, the faithful, will be rich and will be comfortable. Now, when I say it out loud, it sounds really bad. And you're like, no, I don't believe that. I think that's probably too close to the truth, that we have some unrealistic, unspoken expectations about what being a Christian means and what entails that. And when something happens that doesn't fit our internal narrative of what a Christian life should be like, we start to doubt just like these disciples. So someone gets sick in your life. Look, everyone is going to get sick and die in this planet. But somehow, when someone we know and love gets sick, we say, God, are you even real? Maybe you experienced someone you love dearly, maybe someone who loves God incredibly, die way too early. And you're like, now I have all these doubts. Because we made an assumption, if I'm a Christian, then life will go smoothly, comfortably, no one will get sick or die. But that's a false assumption. That is not what Jesus ever talks about and not what the New Testament says. We think that, like, maybe if we lose our job, then we haven't been faithful enough. Or God doesn't like us anymore. Or maybe our marriage has fallen apart. So God must not exist. Like we get confused and doubtful as the disciples when our life's experience doesn't match our Christian expectation. And so I wonder which one is false. Is God false actually not true? Or maybe our Christian expectation is not right. Maybe God didn't promise life on this earth permanently and nobody not to get cancer or get sick or get diabetes or get Alzheimer's. He never promised that. Maybe God didn't promise that nobody would actually die on this planet. He says everybody's going to die. And so maybe I need to fix my internal narrative to match the Bible rather than try to force the Bible to match what I want it to match. And that seems to be the problem for these disciples. Sometimes what happens in our life, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit how God's supposed to act. According to what? According to me. So it's in those times I need to maybe readdress what's going on in my own heart and head. And that's, I think, a part of where faith needs to step in and assure us that God does love us and that He cares deep and passionately about us and that He is always with us, even when we struggle with some of these kind of things that we have in our own heads. Moving on here. They came to Capernaum. When he was in a house, he asked them, what were you guys arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet because on the way they were arguing about who is the greatest again. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and he said, look, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and servant of all. Looks around and he takes a little kid, a little child whom he placed among them. And taking the child in his arms, he says to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. So Jesus is asking about their conversation and they keep silent, which is really good. Because hopefully this is an embarrassed silence. Hopefully some of what Jesus is saying is sinking in, right? They're kind of embarrassed that they were talking about who's better than who in God's kingdom. And that's a good sign. Maybe at least a little bit they're listening to Jesus about like, hey, it's not about that. And he reminds them that God's kingdom works differently than this world. And then he gives them a physical picture by taking this little kid. Now, to us, we think that's really cute. Like politicians pick up babies, get some votes, that kind of stuff. But in the ancient world, kids were the least honorable possible human being on the planet. You see, if you took your slave and you punched your slave in its eye and its eye came out, you'd have to pay the slave or you'd have to free the slave. If you killed a slave, you had to pay the slave's family for killing the slave. You weren't just allowed to kill slaves for no reason. But if you punch your kid and their eye pop out, too bad, kid! If a person thought that their kid was disobedient and killed them, no redress. Sorry. So kids are lower than the lowest possible human being, a slave, in this society. And so when Jesus says, hey, come here, kid. He's not saying, look how cute this is. Look how wonderful these are. You should be nice to those who are pure and innocent. He's not saying that. What he is saying is, you should take this little kid and you should care about this little kid. Put this little kid above you. And this would have been like offensive. It's like taking the worst possible person you can think of and then saying like, this person is above you. You should serve this person. It would have been ridiculous to them. And he gives them that picture. God desires us to serve the least, he says. To become the least. And by becoming the least, we raise that other person up. Look, I love our church and I love all parts of this church. And one of the parts I was thinking about that I super love is that we all, y'all donated money to send to these kids that were in Thailand to help poor kids. And you will never get anything back from that. They're never going to repay you. They're never going to be able to thank you. And you generously sent almost $10,000 over into Thailand. Through your generous giving. That's powerful. That's looking out for the least. Like those kids, they can't even ask. They don't know how. They can't thank you. They're never going to do anything for this church. They're not going to help build attendance. They're not going to help, our spiritual lives. They're never going to teach us a Bible study. And yet you go out of your way and you serve and you bless someone who is least of these. That is fantastic. Jesus the King didn't just tell them about this principle. He actually lived it. He came and he made himself the least. He served us when he should have been the king of us. He died for us when he should have killed us all. Giving us that kind of example. In the worldly idea of power, a great man is distinguished by how many people serve him, but not in God's kingdom. In ancient China, it was fashionable for wealthy folks to grow their fingernails really long. Have you ever seen this in some of the ancient pictures in China? They would grow their fingernails really long, so long that they couldn't do like regular day duties. Like you couldn't wipe your own bum, you know? And the reason they would do this, they were saying, I am so rich and powerful, I got a servant to wipe my bum. I don't feed myself because I don't need to. Someone feeds me. I don't clean up because I don't need to. Someone cleans up. And so this idea that the richer and more powerful you were would mean more and more people serve you. Now, the world may think that that's greatness, but God doesn't. And Jesus declares that true greatness is shown by how many you serve, not how many serve you. Jesus wants us to embrace last as a choice. So he doesn't want you to be last because you're forced to be last. But he wants to say, hey, look, there's another option other than trying to be first all the time. The other option is trying to be last. We're like, no, that's a dumb option. I don't want that one. I want to be first, Jesus. You're crazy. We're just as dumb as the disciples, right? He's saying it pretty clearly. He said, here's a new choice I want you to know is a viable choice. And I know you can do it because watch me demonstrate it. And Jesus demonstrates becoming the least. Teacher, says John, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he wasn't one of us. And Jesus is like, do not stop him. For no one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me. For whoever is not against us is for us. Truly, I tell you, anyone who gives a cup of water in my name because you belong to the Messiah will certainly not lose their reward. Now, I had to frustrate the disciples. Now, Jesus is talking to them, right, about being last, and then he goes, yeah, but there were some other guys who were doing something we couldn't. Remember, they had just not been able to cast out a demon? So I'm not sure they were listening to this part that Jesus just shared with the kid and all that, and they're like, yeah, but these other guys were doing, they're better than us. Like, it's like, shut up. Jesus is like, stop. Don't divide over something like that. If they're for me, then they're not against me. Jesus explains it's not a competition, Christian against Christian. It's a war, God followers against non-God followers. It's a war, Christ followers versus the enemy. And so make sure to fight the right persons. Like, our church is never about getting better than Mariners. That's a pretty good church around here, right? We're not mad when Mariners get a lot of people. We're excited when Mariners has baptisms and new people come to Christ. We're excited when our friends at Bethel unveil a new logo too, like 2 weeks ago, which is like totally stealing from our thunder, you know, that kind of thing. I'm excited that Justin and Dan were doing that, you know, Pastor Justin and Dan, Pastor Dan. And so it's not a competition between Christians. And even some of us, like, we think, like, we get so strict, we start to think of someone like, let's say, Joel Osteen. You're like, oh, yeah, I don't know about him. And we go on, get all keyboard warrior, and we say all these bad things about this person. But the Bible says is pretty clear about not dividing over non-essentials. There may be many in this world that have a different approach than you have, or maybe even a wrong approach. And they may have some teachings that are even wrong, or some teachings that in the Bible that we don't see it that way. But Jesus says, like, don't worry about those things. And so don't ever let things that are non-essential divide the church. Make sure the enemy is the right enemy. It's not one another. It's Satan. And then he gives them another picture back with the water thing. He says, hey, if you give someone a cup of water, God remembers that. It's even in the smallest things that we're caring about the least of these. Like, what's a cup of water? For them, they'd get it out of the well, they'd pour it in the bucket, boom, you reuse the cup. It doesn't cost you anything. And he says, but even in the littlest things, God remembers that. God sees even the tiniest kindness to the least of these, and he rewards it because God is not measuring the gift by its price tag, but by its faith tag. Got that one in there. He says this. Gets that kid back. If anyone causes one of these little ones who believes in me to stumble, it would be better for them if a large millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better you enter life maimed than with two hands and go to hell where the fire never goes out And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. For it's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have 2 eyes and be thrown into hell, where the worms that eat them do not die and the fire is not quenched. So if a small act of kindness towards others done in Jesus' name will be remembered, so will the smallest of causes of stumbling, the least of these. And the punishment is severe. He says it's better for them to figure out a way to go kill themselves than to cause somebody else to sin. It's better for them to chop off their hand and their foot and pluck out their eye than to cause sin in their lives. Now, tragically, I think some people have taken Jesus' words literally. They don't allow for any hyperbole in life. And they've gone on to, there's lots of instances in human history where they've mutilated themselves because of this. Physically mutilated themselves, cutting off hands, pulling off parts, cutting off things that should remain, that God created. In a misguided effort to try to curb sin, as if sin resided in the members of the body, it doesn't. You see, the problem with it, God doesn't want you to enter His kingdom with all chopped off body parts, because if I cut off my hand, my right hand, I still have a left hand to sin. And if I cut off all of my members of my body, that's not where sin comes from anyway. Sin comes from my mind and my heart. And so Jesus isn't talking about literally like cutting parts off. He's saying how serious sin is, so that you should do anything to get rid of it. Because cutting off a finger is not going to make me more righteous by losing a finger necessarily. And then he says, he describes this place of hell. Now, what he's referring to, the word that they use is a Greek translation of a Hebrew word that actually means the Valley of Hinnom. And the Valley of Hinnom is right outside of the city of Jerusalem. In ancient times, they used to do idol worship, and there was this really wicked false god named Molech, which required human sacrifice and child sacrifice. And they used to sacrifice kids there. And then Josiah comes around, King Josiah in the Old Testament, and he gets rid of that place, and he turns it into a dump. Now, they don't have like paper trash like we had. So a dump was a place where you took your nighttime pot and you dumped it, right? So it's a place where all the poo-poo goes, dead carcasses, any like rotting food stuff you dump in there. And they would light it on fire, because otherwise it gets too big. They light it on fire and they would burn it. And so Jesus is saying that's kind of what hell is like, this burning place. But the worms don't even get burned up. They stay there wormy, and it stinks and it's burning. And that, like, he's just trying to say, like, it's really bad, right? That's how horrific it is. How bad is sin that there's this like hot poop fire waiting for you with worms, and you're chopping your hands off and plucking it out? That's how serious sin is, Jesus is trying to say. It gives us this like graphic picture of the fate of those people who don't come to Jesus, the fate of those people who decide to hurt others rather than to help others. And we finish today with this part. He says, everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good. If it loses its saltiness, how could it be made salty again? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace with each other. And that's a really weird phrase, be salted with fire. And because of it, it's led to 1,000 different interpretations. But here's one. Here's my opinion on it. This isn't the Bible. I'm trying to figure out what Jesus is saying here. This is the opinion. I think he just said believers ought to avoid sin. And I would say this part is saying we ought to embrace our saltiness. Now, saltiness was used in, salt was used in every sacrifice in the Old Testament. See Leviticus chapter 2. All Old Testament sacrifices had to be salt put on them. And it's used as a preservative. And so I think he's really saying, like, look, just like avoid sin, make sure to stay salty. Make sure to preserve your rightness with God. Make sure to be careful about that kind of thing. And so Jesus has been telling him, don't argue about being great. Serve the least. Don't let sin ruin your testimony to this world, but remain at peace with one another. Embrace the least and be the least. Let me pray for us, and we're gonna jam out in a worship song and end this morning. Jesus, I just am praying for us. And there's so much going on here. So much in this passage about that I got to sit in, and I got to figure out how to care about others more than I care about myself. I got to figure out, like, I want to have more faith, God. God, I want to be a church that honors you. I want to be an individual that honors you. And I want your kingdom on this planet to honor you. I want us to be united, not divided. Oh, there's so many amazing things that are happening in Simply Jesus today. Would you move us towards your heart so that we could respond rightly to you?